Hello and welcome to the Fitness Unfiltered podcast. We are back, which is very, very exciting. Mike, how are you?
I am fine.
Dan?
I'm amazing.
Oh,
I know, I like mixing it up.
And we have a very special guest, Nicola Hobbs. Thank you so much for your time. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So before we came on, we were talking about your title and how it's exercise and eating psychologist, and how some psychologists have protected terms and others don't. And then we thought, this is actually quite an interesting discussion. So maybe you could elaborate.
Yeah, so to call yourself a chartered psychologist, you have to go through a master's, a degree that's accredited by the British Psychological Society. Then you have to do a master's degree that's also accredited. And then you have to do what's called stage two training, which is a balance of consultancy work and research. So I'm in that third stage of chartership as a sport and exercise psychologist. So the sport and exercise psychologist is a protected title along with things like health psychologist. But if you are, you can call you, anyone can call themselves a performance psychologist or, you know, any other type of psychologist.
You know, actually.
I know. And it's the same with psychotherapist, counsellor, therapist. These aren't protected titles.
Is psychotherapist not protected either? Because I was always interested whether that was within the BPS accreditation. Because I don't, even all masters in psychology, they're not all BPS recognised, are they?
No. I think with psychotherapist, you know, there are so many different governing bodies.
Mm.
And it's, but the Healthcare Professions Council is what protects the title of things like psychologist, dietitian, doctor, I think. Is that right?
Do you know what I find so interesting about that? I would always have assumed, if I didn't know that, that a psychologist would be someone who's like studied psychology. But to be a psychotherapist, you would have to, like, you'd have had to have done extra qualifications and stuff. I'd have always assumed that psychotherapist would be more likely to be a protected title or bestow sort of more of a specialism on the person than a psychologist. But it sounds like that is not true.
Not as far as I know. I don't think so. But I think it's kind of, I think it is a really interesting conversation in terms of, you know, there's lots of personal trainers, for example, who've shifted into mindset coaching and offering kind of more mental health advice without really having any kind of training.
And I'm worried that now that we put this podcast out, all of those mindset coaches are going to change their bios to performance psychologist instead of mindset coach if they find out that that's actually not protected. That's a worry, isn't it?
I mean,
I think like mindset coach does sound like you're like,
exactly.
But like anything, performance psychologist, that sounds like legit.
Snazzy.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because you would think out of any industries that should be regulated by a governing body, the health industry should be one of them. So even
How do you regulate it? Do you kind of have every, you know, ban everyone using psychologist unless you've
You can be whoever you want to be anyway. So it would be how would you police it? That's the trouble.
This is what's so interesting, because actually in reality, the professions that do have governing bodies, like for example the General Medical Council for doctors, I mean, there are huge concerns about how those governing bodies function, how fair they are, how they treat certain sort of sectors of the profession, their sort of allegiance to, you know, the profession versus their allegiance to the people using the profession, like the clients and stuff like that, and how they balance that, and actually whether or not they're truly impartial. So it is a fascinating thing. Like, I think that's something that is all an accusation that's often leveled at the fitness industry. Oh, it should be regulated. Yeah, that's great. But then who regulates it, and how do you regulate those people as well? It's a never ending concern, isn't it?
It's the practicality of it, isn't it? And I think it comes down to, can us as psychologists/slash coaches/slash whatever we call ourselves, it comes down to our integrity as professionals and practitioners. And then also, you know, I think there is a certain responsibility for our clients in actually, if they want to see our qualifications, they feel they can ask us for them.
Not just blank ticks.
Yeah, not just blue ticks. I agree. I think, and unfortunately, and I was thinking about this from like the mentoring standpoint, like unfortunately, sometimes lack of integrity sells, at least initially, until you realize, you know, you're not serving your clients, they're not getting results. And then your reputation starts to precede you in a negative way. And then, so you kind of see, and I was like making a comparison between quick fix diets where, you know, if you're a business owner and if I suddenly was like, I'm a such and such psychologist and blah, 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 blah. And then I had all these, you know, and I bigged myself up and had all these clients. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I'm not actually mm-hmm. a psychologist. I didn't have that level of training. They don't get good results. And then my reputation drops. So I have like this big peak in business and then it drops off. Much like when people start fad diets and they're like, oh, look, I've lost so much weight in 2 weeks. And then it obviously they put the weight back on because they've been massively over restricting. So you can see the same, I guess, patterns occurring.
Yeah, and I think, and I also wonder, like, as practitioners, doesn't it feel when you're not acting from a place of integrity, it feels really icky and uncomfortable. So it's also we're causing ourselves distress.
Yeah, you're assuming that people are good. Like, you're assuming that everyone cares as much as you do about your clients, which unfortunately I don't.
Don't you think that also people tell themselves stories that justify their behaviours as well? I think there are a lot of people who are engaging in shady practices who actually think that they are really... I'd never know the word. I've always used the word integralicious. I know it's not a word. We've used it before on the podcast. But people, what is the word for the adjective of someone who has integrity? Integrified, integralicious.
Intricate, I don't know.
Well, we spoke about integral the other day, but that's not what integral means. But anyway, yeah. I think that there are a lot of people that convince themselves that they have and are acting from a place of integrity when actually they're not. And they think they're helping people, but actually they're serving themselves. And it's really difficult to tell, isn't it, where, you know, where intention ends and where sort of, you know, actual self-awareness starts as well.
I think that's actually a really good place to start, because I'm going to ask you, actually, from a self-awareness perspective, because along with those stories we tell ourselves, I think I'd be interested to know, do you think that eventually catches up with people if they live a life conflicted and not aligning with values they know to hold higher above others?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're not living in alignment with our values, we feel it, and we might not really know what it is. I think values are only just starting to be spoken about within kind of even in mental health and within the fitness industry. And so we might just kind of have this sense of not being very grounded, feeling like a bit of an inner emptiness that we try and fill with external things, or we might be chasing kind of socially compliant goals. And every time we reach them, it doesn't give us that satisfaction. But I do think it's, you know, living our values gives us this stable core that almost anchors us, so that no matter what storms are going on around us, we can kind of say, you know what, living my values is my measure of success.
It's interesting.
Oh, I love that.
I find we take for granted that people are aware of, back to that self-point about we take for granted that people are actually aware of what their own values are, because some people just don't, and I mean this in the kindest sense possible, is they don't have the knowledge and they don't have the vocabulary to articulate exactly what they are. They can kind of give you a vague description of what they might be and what they hold dear, but actually pinpointing exactly what they are, I don't think most people are aware of that. I say most, many people are aware of that.
No, I don't think most people, I wouldn't say I was until maybe a year ago when it was like forced to be like, oh, you need to actually sit down and think about what these are. Like if you ask someone, I would say 99% of the general population what their values are, they would absolutely not really know what you were talking about. And then I think it's so easy to get swayed by other people's values. They'd be like, oh, isn't health a value of yours? You'd be like, oh, yeah. Isn't family as well? Yeah. But actually, it might not be. And having the self-awareness to be like, family is important to me, but it's not in my top three values. Like, and that's okay. And am I living in line with those things? And I think that, I guess, to the point of like people not knowing these things, it's so easy to walk through life not knowing them. And maybe you do feel that air of, oh, I feel a bit incongruent. But also, I think sometimes you only... it's like that's the baseline set that most people feel, and you only feel the benefit when you start living in line with your values. So I talk to the coaches that I mentor about this, like, we always start with, what is your business value? And I always say that you will outwork everyone almost effortlessly if you know why you're doing it. Like, if you can really get down to the bottom of your value, what you want your business to be and who you want it to serve and the impact you want to have, if you're in line with that, you'll work so much harder. And I do think that most people don't know that that's missing, because that's how they've always felt. And it's only when they highlight that and they're like, oh, this is why I'm doing the things, like, everything is now coming together. And it's like going from that baseline, what most people feel, to this higher level of, now I know why I'm doing the things that I'm doing.
Yeah, and I think if we don't know our values, we kind of ping pong between, like you said, other people's values and goals which are meaningless. And it's almost, I think we see it in the diet industry quite a lot, in the sense of following really rigid diet rules that aren't our own, and then maybe ping ponging to anti-diet philosophy, which equally might not actually be in alignment with how we want to eat. And it's, and I always, you know, something I've been thinking about recently is how, you know, rebelling and being anti something is very different to freedom.
Yeah, that's such a fantastic point. And actually, I'm going to get in there with the plug straight away, your book and the questions, Daily Awakening, for all of our listeners. It really prompts, at some point, some uncomfortable introspection. It forces you to ask yourselves really quite difficult questions, which I think, unless you have an interest in this and you're actively seeking out some more self-awareness or a heightened sense of self-awareness, is you don't almost want to uncover these dark, dirty stones in the back of your mind, which, although you take curiously to look at them, they do stir up some uncomfortable feelings.
Do you know what got me? And it was like right at the start, how am I contributing to my own suffering? I was like, that's, and I think it's so freeing as well, because you're like, actually, most of my own suffering is me. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, okay, well, I can change that. And that's like the ownership, and that's what's empowering. Or you can at least accept that, you know what, to some extent, I'm allowing this to happen, or I'm choosing it, which again means it's in my control and I can change that. That's not to say it's going to be easy, but I really, like, I thought that question was really, I don't know what the right word is, poignant, useful, insightful, deep. Yeah.
It's very hard to get that across, isn't it? To kind of, to get across the balance between, you know, have like the personal responsibility aspect of things that you can do there, that the fact that, that, you know, there are plenty of things that you're suffering is obviously not your fault, or is down to kind of circumstances and things that are kind of placed around us by societal issues and constructs and all of those sorts of things. But the idea that you can't change necessarily those things, or you can't change the things that you can't change, but you can change the things that you can change. And there are probably some things that you're contributing to as well that you can change, but it's very difficult. I find this a really tough thing in the world of social media at the moment. Like, it feels like the minute you say something about how someone can improve on something, it's like, well, you don't, it's easy for you to say because you're privileged and you've got all this privilege, and it's not the same for everybody. But then sometimes the people that are arguing that against you are people who are just as privileged as you are, who kind of feel this kind of privilege guilt and apologism that means that they have to justify everything as to why nobody can do better. I thought I heard a really... What's that?
Can't imagine who you're talking about.
No, but actually,
I think the difference there is people internally kind of jump between, oh, it's in my control, it must be my fault.
Mm. Yes.
That's different. Like, it's not fault, it's not blame. Like, none of that really, you know, there could be legitimate reasons for it that have nothing to do with you. It's not about it being someone's fault, but it's your responsibility to change it, or it's basically the empowerment of, you have the ability to change it, rather than it's your fault, you have to change it. It's like, it doesn't matter whose fault it is, you can change.
Or no one else can change. Like, you, the only thing that is changeable is what you can do. So you might as well do that.
And I think sometimes it's helpful to break down the word responsibility in terms of ability to respond. And if you don't have those abilities, then you can cultivate them through practice. And sometimes I just think when we...
Sorry, why are we all so shocked by responsibility being ability to respond?
I've never put that together before, ever.
Me neither. Wow.
Responsibility.
It's like, I love words. I love looking
at... How is that not a meme? How have you not made it a meme? It should be.
It will be after this.
Yeah, we're all furiously on Canva making a meme out of it.
But I think even when we're speaking with clients, it's about saying, you know, like you said, this isn't your fault. Like, if nobody's taught you these skills and these abilities, then we can learn them now as adults.
I think that's often a big, and I like the sentiment, a big complaint of mine in the strength in speaking narrative. Is a lot of people aren't equipped with those skills. They don't know how to articulate themselves. They don't have that, as I mentioned before, that vocabulary. But also, societally, we don't have any lessons on how to passively listen either and appropriately respond to someone when they're at their most vulnerable, when they are trying to offload and they don't necessarily want to be fixed. They don't want solutions. They don't want answers. They just want someone to listen and acknowledge that their plight is heard.
It's almost that skill of holding space, isn't it?
But we're not taught that. It's certainly something I haven't been aware of until, you know, I got a little bit older.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, that's why I think journaling can be so powerful, in the sense of we're learning how to hold space for ourselves without trying to fix, without trying to get rid of anything or force anything, and actually that allows us to hold space for another.
This is one question I wanted to ask you, and something I come up with or come up against, I guess, a lot with clients, and that's kind of expectations around, I was going to say recovery from mental health, but like just improvements of mental health. So whether that's like body image or like the urge to binge eat or something like that, that there's almost this expectation that will completely disappear. Like, yeah, once you've cured yourself of body image issues, you'll never have negative thoughts about body image. Or that these thoughts about overeating will just disappear. And actually, and kind of what you've been talking about in your book as well, is that like those feelings will still be there, but you don't kind of shine the light on them anymore. And you have the ability to kind of let them pass and to observe them, instead of thinking that they inherently mean something or you have to react to them.
Yeah, I think what I've been thinking about a lot lately is the way we interpret these uncomfortable emotions and urges almost as threats. Like, we, you know, it sends a signal to our nervous system, this, whether it's, you know, body image anxiety or shame or the urge to overeat, it's almost like, this is really bad, this, I'm in danger, the only thing I can do to get rid of it is act on it. And I think it takes time to kind of teach our nervous system that these emotions are safe now, and as adults we can handle them and we don't need to run from them all the time.
And this was kind of the question I was going to follow on from, is that the book is meant to be like, I mean, it's a year, right? Like, kind of exercises, it takes a long time. And I think that people realize, like, having those realistic expectations of like, and it's more than a year really, like it's an ongoing journey. Like, no one is fully like all made up mentally and never has any problems, and there'll be, you know, things that trigger you throughout life or like stressful times. So, like, how do you approach that from your work with people, like the expectation of like, when will I get results? Or like, it's hard to manage. I guess that's
the problem
with my clients. It's like, when will I feel X, or when will I?
Yeah. I mean, I think in terms of, you know, goal setting is really important. And, you know, a lot of people come to me saying, I just don't want to feel like this anymore. Or, you know, I want to feel happy, or I want to feel confident. And it's more about, you know, shifting from the emotional goal into something that's actually kind of more practical, more achievable. So rather than saying, I don't want to feel anxious anymore, we might set the goal of, I'm going to learn how to deal with feelings of anxiety in a way that they don't have such an impact on my life. So we're not saying we're going to get rid of those anxious feelings. We're just saying, okay, we're going to learn the skills that can help you work with them.
Yeah, I find that fascinating, because your point when you say about certain coping strategies we develop at certain points in our lives, because I've been doing a lot of reading and actually experimenting with we're amongst friends here, my therapist over the last year, International Family Systems, Richard Swartz's work, and certain, certain parts of us, and often we treat those parts of us like they are defective that we want to rid ourselves of without actually acknowledging that they served a purpose at a certain point in our life. So rather than try to rid ourselves of them, get a bit more curious about them, like what was the reason behind developing them, and how does that transfer into other aspects as well? Because I think, you know, that may be perfectionism, that may be people pleasing. It's, they're all formed for a certain reason, aren't they?
Yeah, and I work a lot from through acceptance and commitment therapy and acceptance and commitment training. And in that, we kind of think about these coping strategies as what's their purpose and are they still working for us? In terms of, is this working to give me the life I want to lead? And if not, am I willing to experiment with alternative coping strategies?
Could you talk through like some of those alternative coping strategies? Like if someone, I mean, most of our listeners are fitness industry. So kind of the big ones I see with my clients are potentially, obviously not binge eating disorder, but overeating when they don't, when they hadn't planned to or they didn't particularly want to. Body image comes up a lot. So like if someone has, let's go with overeating, like if someone has the urge to overeat, what's a different coping strategy that they can use aside from overeating?
So this is going to be super individual to everyone, but I think there is acceptance of the urge and things like urge surfing, which is where you're very kind of present in your body, you move into the experience. But then there's things like if you have a super strong urge to overeat, distraction might actually be healthier for you. And then, you know, it's things like connecting with, you know, making sure you're connected with your values. And kind of saying, if I was to overeat now, is that in alignment with my values? And sometimes it might be, and sometimes it might not.
Sorry to interrupt you. Can I ask you to, for the sake of me, just for clarification, and also the listener, to distinguish between healthy distraction and avoidance?
Again, so I work from contextual behaviorism, which means that everything makes sense in context. So what might be healthy distraction one evening might be a form of excessive avoidance another evening. So it's, you know, psychological flexibility is really kind of what we're aiming to cultivate, which is the capacity to adapt our behavior, our thoughts, our perspectives, depending on the situation we find ourselves in, which is actually really hard when we're so used to living by these rigid rules.
Yeah, and we kind of want those rules as well. We want someone to be like, this is binge eating, this is not binge eating, this is like a good thing, this is a bad thing. And you're so right, like it's not the action, it's kind of the intent behind the action, isn't it? Like sometimes that might actually be a really healthy way to do it, or a good thing, or you're doing it because you want to do it and you enjoy it, as opposed to other times where that isn't the case and it is negative and you are doing it to, I don't know, avoid certain things or as a numbing strategy.
Yeah. I see a lot of that in that. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I think the most important thing is that we realize we're choosing to do it. So we're not acting on autopilot. So it might be that we're saying, I'm feeling really lonely tonight and I don't want to deal with this loneliness right now. So I'm going to go and eat a tub of ice cream. And tomorrow morning, I'm going to sit down and journal on it or reach out to a friend. But right now, this is too much for me.
So can I ask a question about this? Because I think, like, again, one of the biggest problems with social media is these ideas of absolutism and the lack of nuance, obviously, you know, we all know that. But I've seen it talked about a lot with things like with diet sort of behaviours and then the crossover into disordered eating and then the then crossover into things like eating disorders. I've seen people say stuff like, for example, that like that certain acts that people engage in order to reduce their kind of calorie intake are synonymous with eating disorders and are sort of wholly bad and are representative that there's a problem with thinking and all of those sorts of things. And this is something that I've always struggled with a little bit, because I remember one time, a long time ago, and actually it was a personal trainer who I have not like a huge amount of respect for many other reasons, but so I'm not kind of saying this to defend them or saying that this was a reasonable thing to do. But I remember we were talking about kind of strategies of like, because I would always say that I end up overeating in the evening. I get bored, I get tired, I've eaten, I'm full up, but then I start picking at stuff in, you know, in the fridge when I don't really want to, and I should probably just go to bed. And he said, well, why don't you, when you know that you've finished eating and you don't want to eat any more that day, why don't you go and brush your teeth? And then you probably won't want to eat anything, because it sort of signals to you that you've had enough. It's not, nothing's going to, you know, things aren't going to taste nice. And then I remember later, you know, didn't really think about this, and occasionally like sort of used it from time to time as a thing. But again, I'm not sort of brushing my teeth at 3 o'clock because I don't want to eat anymore for the rest of the day, and brushing my teeth at like 9 o'clock when I've had a, you know, decent meal. And I remember somebody putting something on social media about how they saw somebody recommending this, and this is absolutely problematic and, you know, has connotations with eating disorders, very commonly discussed in kind of eating disorder forums and all of that kind of stuff, and is a very commonly used tool for people who suffer with anorexia to limit what they're eating. And this is really, really bad. And I just remember being really conflicted by it, thinking, I don't think it's always really bad. I think it can be really bad. And obviously there are some parts of it that are potentially problematic. But if you're somebody that wants to have a focus on some level of energy balance, and you know that you have a tendency to just eat some crisps when you don't really want to, and it's not in line with your values, then yes, perhaps that's a slightly avoidant tactic and you're not necessarily dealing with the underlying issue. But is it so bad to do that? I wondered like what your thoughts were on those sorts of things and that sort of absolutism.
Well, I think that's what happens when you take the context out of the away from the behavior. And it's almost, you know, I'd be tempted to ask you, well, is that working for you? Does it feel an empowering thing to do or an imprisoning thing to do?
Oh, there's another one. Is it empowering or is it imprisoning?
Empowering or imprisoning. And it's an interesting question, isn't it? Because I think sometimes when you don't give stuff very much thought and you just do it, I could honestly say I was never imprisoned by that action. I don't know that I was particularly empowered by it, but it probably maybe prevented me from overeating on a few occasions when I knew I was bored and tired and probably at risk of overeating. But I think if I really reflect back on it, it probably, like you say, isn't addressing an underlying reason for overeating. That I understand. But B, I just feel like it just wasn't that big a deal. Mm-hmm. And then the idea that it was a bigger deal than it was, I think I found quite imprisoning. Like the idea that somebody was suggesting that I have a problem because I did that, then made me feel quite imprisoned by that sort of way of thinking, I suppose. Like actually, so what, and we're seeing it a lot with all of the calorie printing calories on menus and all that kind of stuff. Like, so what if I choose a brownie because it's a bit less calories than a caramel shortbread? I'm still having I'm not restricting myself. I'm just trying to make slightly more judicious choices based on the circumstances. But again, it feels like it, particularly in that sort of anti-diet world, that there's a lot of pressure to feel like any focus that you have on energy balance is an inherently negative thing and is inherently over-restrictive. And, you know, it's almost, I find it, the moralistic behavior, similar to how the moralistic behavior of diet culture, like the idea that eating clean is better, it sort of feels to me like the idea that eating donuts is better because I'm not tracking calories. I kind of find that dichotomy. And I find a lot of discomfort with it because my background is, again, like I've experienced a significant amount of weight loss and a significant amount of life improvements that I have associated with weight loss. Mm-hmm. So I know that I have a tendency to advocate for weight loss, perhaps from my own biases, but also at the same time, I feel like part of my values are the fact that I went from a very, because I wasn't overweight because of, and I'm really sorry that I'm turning this into a therapy session, I hope this is okay, but I wasn't overweight because of any socioeconomic disadvantages or any kind of societal issues or anything like that. I was overweight because I just didn't really have any sort of focus on that, and I was I guess to me, I sort of viewed it as that I was quite undisciplined. I wasn't interested in physical activity. I wasn't interested in making healthy food choices because I felt young and invincible. And I just really enjoyed eating because I like food. And then as I kind of grew up and sort of developed this kind of idea of mortality and all of those sorts of things, I thought maybe I need to kind of sort those things out. So in some ways, part of my values is that sort of level of discipline and quote unquote looking after myself in many ways. So then I feel like I'm constantly encouraged not to look after myself by making these other choices by a certain sort of sector of this anti-diet world and this sort of part of the nutrition and fitness industry. And then I'm sort of encouraged by my values in another direction. And it then makes, I think it's made me question my own values with regards to my own health and what is important to me about those things.
I think it is really difficult, isn't it? Almost not necessarily when we want to please others, but when we are, you know, very sensitive humans and we're very aware of other people's needs and we don't want to hurt anyone else.
That's my...
Oh my God, she's good.
Whereas actually almost, I think part of almost psychological maturity is this capacity to hold the paradox that for some people in some situations, some of the time, weight loss and knowing the calories on a menu is going to be really helpful. And for some people in some situations, some of the time, calories on a menu is going to be harmful. And almost if we...
I mean, when you say it like that, it almost seems like it's obvious. But it is, like, I find anti-diet messaging, like, I mean the extreme ends of it, kind of hard because I'm like, it just feels too woke to me. I'm like, sorry, but sometimes a little bit of self-control, a little bit of self-discipline isn't a bad thing. And realistically, we live in an obesogenic environment. If you practice no self-control and you rely on your human instincts and urges to overeat, which is what we're driven to do, what do you think is going to happen? Like, to me, I just, like, and it won't be, I don't think we've seen like the fruition of what anti-diet messaging can do, because it won't be funny when people turn around in 20 years and are like, I've got type 2 diabetes now. I'm at higher risk of cardiovascular disease because you told me that it was worse for me to practice some self-constraint than it was for me to just eat whatever I wanted. That's like, that's my concern about it.
Yeah.
And I also wonder whether it can be a bit disempowering as well, because have you heard of the drama triangle?
No.
Which is, it's in part of transactional analysis, which is a therapeutic technique that some psychologists, some therapists use. And it's basically looks at the roles we play in the relationships, which is usually victim, rescuer, and persecutor. So actually, if we're trying to rescue everyone, whether that's through social media by, you know, being really kind of
virtuous.
Yeah, virtuous almost, telling everyone, you know, this is the right thing to do, or very persecutory, I think that's the word, in terms of you shouldn't be doing that, you shouldn't be eating like this. We're actually pushing them into the role of victim.
That's interesting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because
social media does love to do those things, doesn't it? It loves to either be telling people that they're doing everything wrong or telling people that they are doing everything right and they should love themselves. And actually, you know, obviously I'm not saying they shouldn't love, just to clarify before that gets taken out of context. But
I think it places unreasonable expectations on people in a different sense, in that, like the radical body acceptance movement, for example, that everybody should love their body. But it's totally unrealistic to expect people to love their bodies all of the time. So if you do take heed from that message and you don't feel like you love your body, you naturally internalize that and think, I'm doing something wrong. The issue must be me.
Or there's something wrong with me. And I would say to people, part of body acceptance and practicing body acceptance is that actually accepting that sometimes it's really hard to accept your body.
Not because
there's anything wrong with you, but just because you're human.
And I think that's
I think the victim thing is so interesting, because as soon as someone has that like victim mentality, there's no way they will change. Because you're kind of, whether you feel like, you know, social media has done that to you, but as soon as you feel like you are a victim, like there's no way that you're gonna like advocate for yourself or make change or feel empowered enough to, what was it, take responsibility, your ability to respond.
Yeah. I think it's a bit of a cultural shift as well, isn't it? Like this competitive victimhood is we can't be equally outraged for all of these different equally worthy plights. My plight is more important than this person's. And, oh, if you care about that, when you don't care about this. And there are many worthy things to be outraged by people. Just because you're not cross or publicly outing something doesn't mean that, yeah, it's not worth the time. And I just think when we talk about one thing, people are, it's almost become like this self-involved bubble where people can't see. By appearing virtuous, they can't see beyond the tip of their nose.
Yeah, but I think it's currency. This is the problem. Virtue is currency and outrage is currency as well, like particularly on social media. You know, the posts that get the most engagement are the angriest of the posts, and the posts that get the most engagement are the ones that enable sectors of people in the audience reading them to make them feel like they're doing everything perfectly. Like it's this self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? That just people are going to just keep doing that. And it's always the same cycle with every news item. Is people talk about the news item, then people criticize people for talking about the news item. And then people say, but what about this? And then people say, yeah, it's out of order to talk about that because you're not even talking about this as well. And then it just becomes this free for all. It always descends into exactly the same oblivion every single time. And I find that really fascinating as well, particularly like at the moment, in the midst of like some pretty significant world issues that are going on at the moment, that, you know, on one hand, I think, well, we're arguing about calories on a menu, guys, like this is ridiculous. But then on the other hand, there has always been atrocities going on in the world, and there are always horrific atrocities going on in the world. And if we can't then have discussions about anything else, then what's the point in us even sort of, you know, having all this privilege and being around, if we have to keep our mouths shut about everything that isn't threatening our lives directly?
And I wonder if it's almost like acknowledging our privilege, you know, once we've done that, it's almost like, well, how can I use it in the most compassionate way rather than actually denying that we have any?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're all limited in some way, whether that's socioeconomically or neurobiologically.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's kind of just having compassion for all humans, regardless of those limits, whether they have them, whether they have none.
Yeah, and I guess like a really crude but maybe obvious example of that is like if you're someone who has a ton of money, maybe mm-hmm. because you made it, but maybe because your parents left you it, but you choose to, like, instead of being embarrassed by that and hiding it away, you're like, I'm going to choose to do good with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that is accepting and using your privilege as best you can. Yeah.
Like Batman, basically.
Basically the same. Yeah. Yeah. Can we, because I know I'll get in trouble from mostly my clients, if we have you on and we don't talk about like body image strategies, even just a couple of take homes that people could do if they're listening and they're like, it is something that I struggle with. Maybe they're body checking quite often. By the way, I actually didn't know what that was till like relatively recently. Everyone uses that. And I was like, I just used to go along with it and be like, oh yeah. Anyway, now I'm aware. But maybe they're doing that, or maybe they just like don't like their bodies at the moment. Mm-hmm. What are sort of like a couple of like steps that they could take?
So one thing I would say is get to know the thoughts that you have around your body, whether that is, I don't know, my stomach's too fat, or I'm not good enough. Like everyone has this I'm not good enough story that goes around in our heads, whether it's about our body or about our work or about our relationships, and almost see if you can name that story. So one strategy is notice, name, normalize. So notice when that story is coming up, name it as a body image anxiety story, and then normalize it almost by saying, okay, of course I'm going to feel anxious about my body right now. It's changing shape, or it's the society that I live in. Everyone feels anxious about their body sometimes. And actually just, it's a bit like Christine Neff's self-compassion practice in terms of when we connect with the rest of humanity, it can help us realize, oh, there's nothing wrong with me for feeling this way, and it's actually okay. And then I think another thing is when we're just practicing acceptance, and that can be a really embodied practice like placing our hand on our heart, and kind of we don't necessarily want to get rid of that body image shame, body image distress, but it's about saying, okay, can I hold it gently rather than letting it yank us around.
Can I ask a question? Because I think that we also have a lot of people that listen to us that sort of function in that sort of physique space, where actually a lot of their values are based on their physique. Like they might, you know, either be people who have either struggled with body image in the past and have made sort of significant kind of body shape changes and body composition changes and stuff, but also people that are into stuff like bodybuilding and physique sports and you know, actually kind of not necessarily judge their worth, but a significant part of their daily functioning is based around making improvements in their physique. Are there any particular kind of messages that we can kind of give to those sorts of people who, I guess, do need in some ways for their hobby or their professional, whatever it is, to kind of be motivated by making improvements to their body, but who also want to balance that with, because I know a lot of people in that sort of situation who suffer with a lot of self-hate, people who are in better shape than, you know, most people would possibly dream of, but yet are very unhappy with their bodies because they feel that it's not good enough. And I think that they suffer from a lot of guilt as well, because they feel like they should be a lot happier, because they recognize that logically they are in amazing shape by other people's standards, but just not by their own. Anything that we can sort of say to those people, or do they just need to speak to a therapist, really?
I think, again, it comes back to values. Like, we can diet from a place of harshness and hate, or we can diet from a place that is in alignment with our values, whether that be compassion, discipline, hard work, and we can almost speak to ourselves, you know, critically or compassionately. And I think these are, you know, like we said at the start, like, these are all skills we can train. If we've been speaking to ourselves really harshly for years, it's going to take a bit of practice to develop the neural pathways, mm-hmm. where compassion becomes our default. But again, it's almost like if what you're doing isn't working for you right now, then you can always pivot.
Mm-hmm.
And you can always change.
That's a limiting belief as well. Like, I get this quite a lot. Like, you're such a positive person. Like, I wish I was more positive. Mm-hmm. It's not a mistake. Like, I did a lot of work to,
yeah.
And like you're saying, it does over time. Like, initially it took a lot of like conscious effort to be like, what am I grateful for? How can I frame this into a positive? And like, I had to do the work on that, and I had to write in a journal every night to do that. And now I don't feel like I have to do that anymore, because I naturally, my mind gravitates to, okay, that's rubbish, but is there any like positives we can find from this? Or what else could I do with that time now that I'm not doing X with it? And my mind naturally does that now. But I think that we kind of think that, oh, this is a negative person, this is a positive person, it's not my fault, I'm just the kind of person that sees the glass as half empty, blah, 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 blah. Like, actually, that's something you can change. And that's like something that we should be working on.
Yeah. And I think even just, you know, giving people a bit of psychoeducation in terms of how the mind works can be really powerful. So, for example, there is no delete button in the nervous system. So we can't necessarily get rid of neural pathways, but we can overwrite them. And I think that's why sometimes when we're really stressed, we do go back to those old coping strategies that aren't healthy, because actually they might have been wired in for years.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that we can't learn these skills, like compassion, like what's called cognitive diffusion, where you learn to separate yourself from your thoughts, like present moment awareness. But it's like when we learn any other skill, like juggling or handstands or learning a new language, when we're learning these psychological skills, it takes practice. And it's almost like we need rep sets recovery to make progress on them.
Yeah. And I guess it's hard for people because it's less tangible.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And you can make it tangible. You can be like, I'm gonna journal for the next 365 days, or you know, you might start with 30 days and then see how I feel. Because I think from my experience with a lot of people, they're like, oh yeah, I tried journaling for 3 days, or like, I tried practicing gratitude for a week, when I saw someone else was doing it. And it's like, yeah, you need to be doing this stuff for far longer than that to actually start to see the benefits, because you're not going to see it straight away. And it's much like, as much as like Dan and I are probably bored of like telling people, you know, you've got to do these behaviors for longer than you think to start losing body fat. And, you know, that's a lot of our job. It's even like, you know, times 10 for the mental work behind that, that you won't be able to see the progress. There's no scale showing you that it's going in the right direction. Like you, and I think a lot of the time it only, there'll be like a certain situation and you're like, oh wow, I'm really present here and I'm really enjoying it. And oh, that is all the work that I've been doing. Yeah. But you don't kind of see it in a stepwise fashion.
It's a hard sell, isn't it, in a day and age of instant gratification? Because as you said, it's not tangible. Because I find it fascinating that people are more than happy to meticulously plan and input every morsel that enters their mouth on MyFitnessPal. But the suggestion that they would spend 5 minutes checking in with themselves and writing down a few thoughts in their head at the start of every day just blows their mind. They're just not prepared to give it a chance.
I wonder whether it's because it's not spoken about that much. Like most of the time when I talk about psychological skills training, no one has any idea what I mean, because we don't see things like compassion as a skill. We think, you know, you're either, like you said, I mean, you're either a compassionate, positive person or you're not. Rather than actually treating it like, no, this is something we have to work on and we have to train. And I mean, there are sometimes with clients, I use different kind of validated questionnaires that help measure different things. And that can be quite motivational if you do it every, you know, at the start of when you begin journaling or meditating, for example, and then 6 weeks later, and you see, oh yeah, my actions are more in alignment with my values. Mm. Or I am more compassionate towards myself. Because I mean, ultimately, what's the point in achieving these big, huge goals if we're still mentally beating ourselves up at the end of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you got any tips on turning down the inner shitty committee, the volume on that? Because I think that's what a lot of people will resonate with and a lot of people will suffer from time to time with.
I would thank them. Thank you, mind. Thank you for trying to protect me, but I'm all right now. I've got this. Because that's what, you know, all of these things that often we think of as negative or sabotaging behavior, it's always protecting us.
Mm.
Even though sometimes it's overprotective.
Yeah, I think what you were saying before about normalizing things and being like, actually, you know, as much as I don't know, because I'm not in anyone else's head, like normally when you start speaking about these things, other people are like, oh yeah, I'm really negative to myself as well, or I have tendencies as well. I've had, and something you said again, or like a one-liner that I loved, and you can tell that you really love writing and English and words, but it was, one of the paradoxes of awakening is that it's both deeply personal and profoundly universal. And I thought, it is, there's nothing that could be more personal than this kind of stuff, like than your own negative self-talk. But it's universal as well. Like, I don't know, apart from like psychopaths, I don't know people that, you know, don't have like limiting beliefs, negative self-talk, don't have body image issues at certain times. We all have it. And I think that, like you're saying, part of like the normalization and the acceptance of it means that you can, that can still maybe be there in the background, but it's not at the forefront anymore.
Yeah. And I think that's the problem is like we've touched on before, is almost we think we need to get rid of this inner shitty committee, whereas actually we can just let them sit there and do their thing while we pay attention to what really matters to us.
Mm.
And I think for some people it comes with a bit of grief with realizing, oh, I'm never going to get to this place where I'm this perfect person and I never have any anxiety or any kind of shame. But actually the reality of this is, we're not aiming to be gods and superhumans. We're always going to be fully human with all these kind of fragilities and flaws and failures.
Yeah, well, there's a spectrum of human emotion as well, and that is the human experience. We can't experience the highs of one if we haven't felt the depths and the despair of others. You know, like, can you truly experience happiness if you've never felt unhappy?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you distinguish between the two if you've never experienced them?
And I also wonder whether it ties into a lot of people when they come to me, they come and say, well, I want to find my true self, or I want to live more authentically. And almost you can't, you know, being your authentic self means okay, when I'm happy, I'm going to be happy. When I'm sad, I'm going to be sad. When I feel shame, I'm going to let myself feel shame. Rather than saying, oh, this true authentic self only ever feels the pleasant emotions and only ever feels motivated and doesn't kind of have to deal with those vulnerabilities.
What are your thoughts on self-actualization?
What do you mean by self-actualization?
Well, that, like, I also don't 100% know what I mean by it. Like, because people talk about it as if it's like this, all right, so the pinnacle would be self-actualization. Mm-hmm. It's almost like what I was thinking of, and you were like, and you'd become this person who only feels good emotion, and it's just like the perfect human and completely well-rounded and fully self-aware and all these things. Like, do you think, I mean, I think part of the joy of like the inner work is that you'll never be done.
Yeah, there's no finish line.
And I don't know, like, I don't know enough about self-actualization, but like the concept to me seems like that's the end. That's the end. Like, so would you ever really get there anyway?
Or is self-actualization realizing there is no end?
Maybe. Because I think
yeah, I don't know. That's a guess.
Yeah. Sometimes it's because it's the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And actually Maslow never designed that in it as a hierarchy. And that was actually a marketing company that put it into a pyramid.
Mm.
So, which is interesting when you look into the history of these things. And there's a psychologist called Scott Barry Kaufman, and he runs a podcast called The Psychology Podcast. And he's written a lot about Maslow. And then also there was a shift from self-actualization to self-transcendence, which is this sense of, well, my understanding of it, I think it's almost a non-verbal experience of transcending the selfish needs and feeling more motivated by
ayahuasca.
What?
Yeah. Like, it sounds a little bit like this, but I don't know.
I don't know. But maybe but I think that's what people experience when they go into deep states of meditation and experience psychedelics, is this boundary blurring effect between the self and another. And so actually, you know, when you're, you know, there is no, the selfish little I begins to disappear a little bit.
Mm. I think I get like a glimpse of that a little bit. This is such a like base comparison, but when I think about like the universe and how just completely insignificant like my whole life is, or even like all of the generations that I can think of, my own family, like how that is actually just the tiniest speck.
Mm-hmm.
And some people I think find that really like almost depressing,
whereas
I find it really freeing. I'm like, if I make a mistake tomorrow, like it could not matter less. If it, like, even if I made the biggest mistake in the world, like it couldn't matter less. So I think sometimes that is quite freeing, and I guess it comes from like having perspective and then seeing yourself as like how insignificant you are.
Yeah. But I think sometimes it's terrifying, isn't it, when we realize, you know, nobody really cares what we're doing with our life. Like, literally, we don't, there's no one we really have to ask permission from or seek approval from. It's just we have this, you know, obviously within our limits, like we've talked about, but we generally have a huge amount of freedom in how we live. And sometimes I think it's terrifying when we realize that too soon, and almost we need a bit of an ego to, you know, I think it's Richard Rohr, I think maybe a Christian teacher, don't quote me on that. I've read a couple of his books, and he talks about almost we need to develop this ego as a container and as a vessel before we can fill it. And these are kind of the two different tasks of, we need to have a certain amount of ego before we can do the more spiritual transcendent work.
Yeah, because it's often said, I mean, there's that book by Ryan Holiday, Ego is the Enemy. Ego's for self-preservation. It's there as a protective mechanism. It's there for a reason. It does serve a purpose. It's not necessarily the enemy.
Yeah.
But I think that's like, it's interesting, the whole creating your own constraints. And so much of what I've been doing, a behavioral science course, and so much of it is like the realization that people think they want choice, but they actually hate choice. And when you give too much choice, people just won't make a decision.
Yeah.
So I think so much of probably our psychology is creating these constraints so that we actually do things like, oh, I couldn't possibly do that or that or that. Because realistically, you could have any job in the world, you could have wherever you want. Like, yeah, I know there's practical like steps in the way, but most people listening to this on their iPhone probably can live anywhere in the world, but they put these like constraints in place so that they don't have to make these huge decisions. And actually they don't really want that many options. And most people will go flow and they'll go with the, you know, if you've opted them into something, they'll just go with that, even if it's not in their best interest, because they'd rather not make that decision.
And I wonder whether, you know, part of that is actually, we find it quite scary to trust ourselves and to trust in what we want and how we feel. And also in our capacity to handle what life is going to throw at us.
I think it's regret. I think if you make the decision yourself, you leave yourself open to like regretting that decision. Whereas if you're like, well, you know, that like you don't feel as much regret when you didn't make the decision yourself. It's even like the most basic example is when you're going out for dinner and someone's like, oh, I don't really care where you get, we go. And you're like, oh, I don't really care either. And it's like you just don't want to make a decision because you're avoiding making any kind of decision. Whereas if you were just like, this is where we're going, like people are like, oh, thank God you made a, like, you made a choice.
So I think then it's almost like if we can learn the skill of emotional acceptance of how I can accept regret, then actually that's really empowering in the sense of, okay, you know, this regret isn't a problem if I experience it, but I can still take conscious action and make choices that matter to me.
Yeah, it's similar to the book Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, where she's saying like the underlying concept of like all fear comes down to I won't be able to deal with this consequence. So if you have like fear of failure, you're like, usually it comes back to I'm worried that basically my ego won't be able to deal with the fact that I failed, and then I won't be able to get over that, or like I don't want that negative emotion. That's what you're scared of. And I think as soon as you identify that, you're like, that's not a good reason not to do this. What, because I'm scared that my own ego will be bruised? And failing's the same. It's like normally we're worried about what other people will think if we then have to try again. Like, that's not a reason not to do something. Like, actually, realistically, no one else is looking at you. They're all worried about their own problems.
Often that fear of failure is our perceptions of failure, because a lot of people not willing to fail at something is in something they've never tried anyway. I was gonna say, we don't know what the outcome is. We catastrophize and we ruminate on the possibilities, inevitably falling on worst case scenario. It's not like we run through every single sequence of events that could possibly happen. We naturally just jump to worst case scenario, which stops us from even giving it a go in a lot of instances.
Yeah, which I suppose does come back to that. We're doubting our capacity that we can cope with the pain of failure.
I'm glad we worked that out together.
Yeah, well, we got there. I think this has been an incredible episode, and thank you so much for coming on. And I know that you won't promote your own book, but The Daily Awakening is incredible.
Are we putting this on YouTube? Are we? Oh,
that's the book. Realistically, Dan, no.
No, okay.
But we will put a link to the book.
Yeah, let's do that.
Oh, thank you.
Because it's incredible, and it will really make you think. And I think one of the biggest, in fact, I know one of the biggest barriers to people doing this kind of work or the work is like people willy-nilly be like, well, just journal. And like, what do I ask myself? Where do I write it? Who, you know, this gives you a little bit of structure. It kind of probes you with certain questions. And there's definitely certain chapters that would be more or less applicable to you. And maybe you take out certain questions and you journal on them for a period of time. I don't know if anyone else finds this, but I find that the same question gets a bit stale after a period. Like if I'm always journaling on the same question. Anyway, there's a hell of a lot to think about in that book. So I would 100% recommend going and getting yourself a copy.
Yeah. I think especially it's the uncomfortable questions as well that you'd if you were to look at a list of 100 journal prompts, you'd stick to the ones you think you could answer straight away. This forces you to ask the uncomfortable ones. And, you know, from a self-awareness point of view, I think I might mention this to you before. I think this is why a lot of people struggle with meditation, because actually being alone in your head, curiously leaning into all your thoughts, can be quite an uncomfortable process sometimes. And that's often why people don't give meditation a go either, because they just think naturally it just doesn't work after a couple of attempts.
Do you ever worry that someone will steal your journal and like put it on Facebook?
No.
I always worry about, I was like, what if it gets into the wrong hands? And I would be so really
boring. Like, there's nothing, there's nothing particularly interesting in it. And none of it would make sense.
I don't think anyone could read my writing. It's literally just, I never even read it. I don't know what's
I can't read my own writing. So highly doubt anyone else could.
I quite like, are you familiar with Gabby Bernstein's Page of Rage?
No.
So it's this concept that revolves around, I think it's adapted from someone else's work, so I don't think she even takes credit for it, but it's if that uncomfortable, unnerving feeling that you feel sometimes that you can't quite get to grips with, give yourself 20 minutes of just writing. It doesn't need to be directed journaling. Just write for 20 minutes and then just another 20 minutes of stillness. Now, can everyone find 40 minutes a day to do that? I don't know. I personally can't. I'd love to hear from someone that gives that a go. So the Page of Rage, just continually write for 20 minutes, whatever's in your head, and then just sit with those thoughts. It can be your version of meditation, whatever that is. It can be lying down comfortably and having a nap, but she suggests just stillness, no external noise, just have your Page of Rage and sit with it.
Can you do it for 10 minutes?
I'm sure you could. I'm just sharing our suggestions. Five minutes.
I just think like it's similar to those like morning routines. Someone's like, so you wake up at 3 a.m. and then for 2 hours you sit and think about your life and then you do all this and then you cold shower, hot shower, cold shower, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
I literally brush my teeth, wash my face.
Yeah, I have no morning routine. I have a 5-year-old and an 8-month-year-old.
That's a pretty solid routine. Yeah. Okay. I will wrap this up, but thank you so much for your time.
That was amazing. Thank you so much.
Let everyone know, what's your Instagram handle so they can tag you and say how incredibly insightful this was?
It's Nicola Jane Hobbs.
Perfect. And that's it. Shall I stop recording?
Thanks, everyone.